Figure out where we're going today.
Take it one at a time.
Take it one at a time. Call the House Healthcare Committee to order and open a work session on HB 2009. An old chestnut we have.
2009.
2009. That's about healthcare reform, as I remember. And we have a set of amendments before us. Mr. Burns, will you join us? Do I have those amendments? It looks like I do. Could I have a motion on the A70 amendments, please?
Mr. Chair, I move we adopt the A70 amendments dated 4-2109 to House Bill 2009.
Mr. Burns, can you tell us what we got here, please?
Mr. Chair, members, for the record, Tom Burns, Health Policy Consultant to the Chair. When we met last, you were looking at a set of amendments, the Dash 55 amendments. It became clear that those amendments were, I'm sorry, the Dash 64 amendments. It became clear that those amendments were amending a section that you had already taken certain action to. The Dash 70s addresses that problem. It is designed to address some concerns that are brought to us by the insurance industry. It puts some dates into it, makes it clear that the public plan must come back to you for approval, that the exchange must come back to you for approval, and fixes the chaptering out as or the overlay of amendments.
Okay. Is there any discussion on the A70 amendments? Is there any objection to the A70 amendments? A70s are now apart. Join a long list of amendments related to the House Bill 2009. Can I have a motion on the Dash 71s?
Mr. Chair, I move that we adopt the Dash 71 amendments to House Bill 2009. They are dated April 22nd of 09.
Can you help us with this one, please?
Mr. Chair, members, this is the provisions of Senate Bill 453, effectively known as the All Claims, All Payer Database. This amendment reflects the action of the Senate Health Committee, and it is passed out of that committee to Ways and Means.
Thank you. Is there any discussion on the A71s? This is an important piece of the recommendations of the Oregon Health Fund Board to create an all-payer, all-claims database. And I think this passed out of there without much opposition. Is that?
I don't remember, know, Mr.
Don't
Chair.
Know.
I just know it was passed.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, what Senate bill number was this?
It was Senate Bill 453.
Okay. Thank you.
Is there any objection to Senate Bill 453?
Also known as the Dash 71.
Is there any objection to the Dash 71s, a.k.a. Senate Bill 453? So moved. Can I hear a motion on the Dash 73s, please?
Mr. Chair, I move we adopt the Dash 73 amendments to House Bill 2009. They are dated April 22nd.
Mr. Burns, can you clue us on this one?
Yeah, Mr. Chair and members, this is the provision of Senate Bill 454. It is designed to require certain health facilities report data. It's not claims, but it's data about capacity, demand for health care services, as a means to get a better handle on whether we want to move forward with various health facilities in the state.
Okay. Is there any discussion on this? Dr. Smith, can... Yes, sir.
No.
Could you just help us a little bit with the Dash 73s, please, which was Senate Bill 454?
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, Janine Smith, Administrator, Office of Health Policy and Research. This is reflective of the Dash 2 amendments that were added to 454 in the committee a couple of days ago. And do I have my notes, chief notes? No. And basically, it asks us to set some parameters around transparency of healthcare information from healthcare facilities. It has us setting some agreed-upon standards for reporting, where entities would have to report to us based on if they're doing capital construction versus capital expenditures, and there was some parameters around that. There was also in terms of if you didn't report, there's some penalties. That's pretty, and there was us working in collaboration with the DCBS in terms of developing this. And it was vetted with multiple work groups, and we went round and round, and this was what was eventually passed by the committee, by the Senate
committee. Pretty good consensus, huh?
There was some disparity over the issue around construction limitations versus the capital expenditures. We were trying to set it so that it was fair to large entities, large hospitals versus small hospitals, and that it was a percentage. There was a competing proposal from the Hospital Association about this, that the committee chose to go with the dash twos instead of the dash ones, which is what you have before you.
Great. Tom, do you have a comment on this? You want to let us know?
I'm just having trouble figuring out exactly what this does.
Yeah, well, we'll have a little help.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Tom Holt with the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. I think there's a little bit of confusion about which Senate bill we're referring to. The A71s actually track Senate Bill 454.
Right.
The A73s, yes. I believe, track
the
database, which I think is 453.
No, the database was on the one we just looked at.
What we're discussing at the moment, subject-wise, is the
Mr. Chair, I relied on LC, who gave me a note and said that these were. So, in the
okay. The question is: does anybody know which Senate bill the A73 is related to?
But as to the subject matters,
Chair Greenlick, to answer your question, the A73s is the All Payer All Claims database. The 71 is the transparency. So the 73s reflect 453, the 71s reflect 454.
Correct.
Which is why I was confused when you asked me these questions, because I was looking at the wrong.
The 73 is the All Payer All Claims
database.
Correct.
And that one was passed. It was unanimous. Everyone was happy.
The 73s were. And there was no problem with it. So what I would suggest we do is put the 73s back, put 73s in, and reopen the 71s if there's any question on that. Is that?
Yeah. Okay.
That's great. Is there any objection to the adding the A73 amendments? Hearing none, the A73s are added. Let's reopen the discussion on the A71s.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to speak specifically to what is in your amendment, section 1171, and I'm sorry, I'm seeing it for the first time myself, so give me a second. Here it is. Yes, in section 1171, and just to recap where the Senate discussion was, there were two things that the bill did. One had to do with insurance, on which I'm not really prepared to speak, but my understanding is that there were some concerns on the part of the insurance industry about that language. In section 1171, what we came up with was a step toward transparency in reporting capital projects for DRG hospitals, and we chose a percentage of gross patient revenue as a trigger to cause a report, and that report would take the form of hospitals posting prominently on their websites information about construction projects, capital projects, that are in a value in excess of 5% of gross patient revenues for type A and B hospitals and 1.75% for DRGs. And the idea being that a percentage approach makes that scalable across facilities and captures relative to those facilities projects of great significance. And then there is a hard dollar figure for the ambulatory surgical centers of $2 million. Where we had some disagreement and on this issue was in sub B, having a hard dollar figure of $1 million on purchases of equipment. And our objection to that is that, one, it's a hard dollar figure that we will eventually have to come back and revisit. But more importantly, it's singling out hospital equipment versus some entities out there that I think are the larger concern, such as freestanding diagnostic centers that may be driving some issues around equipment. The difficulty there is that diagnostic centers are not defined or licensed currently in statute. And while I think we would welcome an in-depth discussion of that issue and whether there ought to be reporting of their equipment as well as ours, it's a bit late in the game to try and take on a project of defining an entity and licensing and all that. Our suggestion in regard to that issue would be to move forward with the reporting of construction capital projects on the percentage method that's laid out here that we've agreed to, and that by the underlying definitions of capital projects would capture projects that include equipment or equipment on its own if it exceeded that threshold, but then have, you know, queue up a serious discussion in the interim about the broader issue of equipment wherever it may reside, and whether or not we need to, you know, define, license, do whatever in order to capture information about that. The information, I should add, that we would report from the hospital standpoint would also be transmitted to UPR, and then that could be aggregated and you know, made known in that way. And we would also be required to provide a means for public input and to describe the public benefit of each project.
Well, Tom, how about if we go with it the way we have it, because they pass it in the Senate, and we'll put it seriously on our, we're creating our interim agenda. We'd be happy to move that on to the interim agenda and have a serious discussion. Yeah, I think what you're saying is, I'm a radiologist, I'm a single, there I am in my little office, I put a PET scan back there, and it doesn't get exposed in any way.
Exactly.
I don't think I will do it, but... I'm sorry. I'm in the rule.
So, yes, we welcome that discussion.
I'm trying to reconcile a conflict. If you have a philanthropist that donates $1 million to purchase a piece of equipment, and assuming the piece of equipment costs, well, regardless, anything over $1 million, in B, on lines 24 through 30, I read that to say that you would have to report it. And on the next page, I read it on page 3, line 1 and 2, that you wouldn't have to report it.
Dr. Smith, you want to help us with that?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Maurer, and Janine's happily punting to me on that. The provision at the top of page 3 would exempt from reporting projects that are entirely funded through charitable dollars, and that would, or the threshold, it would have to be 100% funded. So if, you know, the Gates Foundation were to parachute a bunch of money down onto a hospital, that would not be
They don't do that.
They don't do that, but it'll be nice, and we can wish.
The Green Lake Mower Foundation could.
And yeah, Chair Green Lake, Representative Mower, that came out of the work group discussions to try to find some balance for that particular instance. And again, in the previous page, it's that they just need to report it. It's not that anyone's saying they can't spend over $1 million. It's just that the purpose from the health fund board was transparency so that the community knew what was going on. Originally, this bill had public meetings, and that seemed a little bit onerous to the reporting entities, and so it was more that they put it up on a public website, and we also would have the data and aggregate it and have it available. So it was kind of a where we landed.
Mr. Representative.
No, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have to have a better understanding. I realize it was part of the health fund, the recommendations about the public transparency for construction products, but I'd love to hear it articulated. Maybe, Tom, the public benefit for doing that. I mean, information for information's sake or information because there's a specific health benefit, public health benefit that arises from that information?
Chair Green Lake, Representative Bruin.
I'm talking about the construction, not the equipment side.
Yeah, it's an excellent question. I think our expectation would be that we would describe the general public benefit in terms of health of a new facility. I think most of our facilities probably do a little bit, do some of that anyway. You know, people don't just sit in a room and say, gee, it'd be neat to have a new cardiac unit, for example, they do seek feedback from providers, from the communities that they serve. This would just formally trigger a reporting mechanism so that, you know, if someone happens on the website, they could see that, you know, some project is being contemplated or is underway, and if they have comment about it, then they could submit that, and then we would receive, our members would receive that.
And Chair,
follow up to that?
That's Dr. Smith.
Okay.
Chair Greenlake, Representative Maurer, the thinking from the Health Fund Board is that the communities often end up having a stake in what is built for lots of reasons, but also it gets translated into costs and higher costs perhaps translated onto their health care costs. And so having, you know, not everyone always follows everything, was trying to get increased community participation and awareness of what was going on in their community so that also the insurers were, you know, it sometimes comes back that they end up having to pay for some of those through increased billing later on, was raised in some of the discussions when we had this in the delivery committee of the Health Fund Board.
I appreciate that answer, and Mr. Chair, I just, if I may, this isn't a new issue. This is an issue that's been around for a while, and, you know, my belief has always been that healthcare providers build the facilities to meet the healthcare demand, and I hate putting into, I'm a little remiss about putting into something as big as 2009 a conduit to throw a wrench into what a healthcare provider thinks is required to meet their demand, and that's the only thing I see happening with this.
There is a well-received theory in the healthcare literature dating back to the early 50s. That states,
if you build it, they will come.
that supply creates demand in the healthcare field. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's evidence on both sides of that, but I think it's that notion that causes both certificate of need and this kind of transparency thing. And it's to the extent it's true or it's not true, making information available to the public doesn't seem to be harmful. I think that's the...
Mr. Chair, I would just add that, you know, this is another area where I think there's a real crisis of confidence on the part of the public. And I think, you know, the more transparency there is, the more that the fears that people have about, you know, abuse of these this construction and those purchases will be assuaged. So, you know, I think it has value just for that reason.
Okay. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
We stand at ease for about 1 minute, please. Can I have a motion on the -74s, please?
Chair, I move we adopt the Dash 74 amendments to House Bill 2009. They are dated April 22nd.
Do we have the Dash 74s in front of us?
Yes.
Tom, you...
Can I ask a procedural question? I was under the impression that we're reopening the 71s, and that was the discussion.
I decided to just move it in. If there's a strong feeling that we want it to come out,
You did make a motion.
Didn't we actually move it?
We already moved it in.
It's already been moved in. I opened up discussion
of it. Okay. So we're past that now. I guess my question
was... We're past that unless...
When we originally passed it in, we really didn't... We didn't know what we voted in.
Right.
Right.
Now that we do...
Now
we do. Thank you. The committee wants to reopen it. We can reopen it.
I would like to vote on that, frankly.
So what you need to vote for is the suspension of the rules. Is that right?
Yeah.
Yes.
To reconsider the vote on...
Dash 71.
On the Dash A71 amendments. Would you call the roll on the move? It takes, what?
Seven
votes to suspend the rules.
I'm sorry to cause a delay with this.
No, it's fine.
So I want to hear the motion. Sorry.
The motion is to reconsider our vote on the Dash 71 amendments.
Okay.
It's to suspend the rules
reconsider the vote.
To allow to reconsider the vote on the Dash 71s.
Representative Barreto.
Aye.
Representative Cannon.
Aye.
Representative Devereaux.
Aye.
Representative Garrett.
Aye.
Vice Chair Harker.
Aye.
Representative Kenemer.
Aye.
Representative Kotek.
Aye.
Vice Chair Maurer.
Aye.
Representative Thompson.
Aye.
Chair Greenlich.
No. The motion passes, and what's the next step now to?
Now you are back to the Dash 71, and there's been no action on it.
All right. Can I have a motion to approve the Dash 71 amendments?
There's been no action on it.
Right. You just by
we rescinded
it.
We just suspended the rules.
Yeah, all we did was suspend the rules so we can reconsider.
Now we reopen it.
Now you need to make to make a motion to rescind.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash A71 amendments to House Bill 2009.
True.
It's still in, Mr. Chair.
It is still in right now.
All we've
done
is suspend the rules.
We have suspended the rules to allow us to reconsider the motion.
Right.
If there is no motion to reconsider, then we just go on.
Right.
But we have the authority to reconsider our vote.
To
so if there is a motion to reconsider the vote, then we will reconsider the vote.
Mr. Chair, I'm just trying to vote no on this. Whatever.
Okay.
Whatever it takes to put that on record, I would like
to
do that.
Good. Make a motion to reconsider.
I would move that we reconsider our vote on the Dash A71 amendment.
Okay. There's a motion before us. A yes vote on the motion before us, as I understand it, allows us to
revote.
To have a new motion and vote on the new motion. So is there any objection to the motion to whatever he just said?
Reconsider.
To reconsider.
No objection.
No objection. Okay.
Would you like to make a motion?
Now, can we have a motion on the Dash 71?
Same old motion.
Right.
Yes, I'd like to once again move that we adopt the Dash 71 amendments to House Bill 2009. They were dated April 21st, I believe, and 22nd.
Representative Harker has moved the Dash 71 amendments be added to 2009. In terms of the discussion, it's just that I just want to say I favor this because we've agreed to move the things out of the governor's package that the Senate has approved, and the Senate committee has approved. This is the last one. Would you call the roll, please?
Representative Cannon.
Aye.
Representative Devereaux.
Aye.
Representative Garrett.
Aye.
Vice Chair Harker.
Aye.
Representative Kenemer.
Aye.
Representative Kotek.
Aye.
Vice Chair Maurer.
No.
Representative Thompson.
Aye.
Chair Greenlick.
Representative
Bruin? No. Yeah, that's the one we were waiting for. Now try me. Yes. I think the minority is trying to confuse me, so I don't know how.
Mr. Chair, if I had known it would take that long, I would not have done it. I apologize.
The motion carries.
Again.
A motion on the Dash 74s, please.
Commitment to transparency on this.
Mr. Chair, I move we adopt the Dash 74 amendments to House Bill 2009. They are dated April 22nd.
Mr. Burns?
If I can get this one right, Mr. Chair.
This is an easy
Better.
One.
This simply adds an emergency clause to the bill to allow the work to begin immediately.
Upon signing of the bill. Is there any discussion? Yes, sir.
I won't object.
Okay. Is there any objection to the motion? The dash 74s are
adopted.
Are adopted. Now, yes, sir.
Mr. Chair, may I move the dash 75s to House Bill 2009, April 22nd, 2009, and what this...
Do we have to undo something? Well,
no.
Okay.
What this is referring to, the health care guidelines that were adopted the other day, and it makes a change in that it provides for a definition, which is on page 2, lines 11 through 22, which provides a definition for comparative effectiveness research. And the purpose is, and the primary purpose is, that comparative effectiveness is a loaded term, and that it has primarily been used as a tool for rationing health care. And if we're using research to compare treatments, procedures, and services based on risk and benefits, that's fine, but it has been bastardized into a conversation of cost containment as the sole focus. And therefore, what I'm saying is, I don't want cost to be the sole focus. I'm not saying it can't be a part of the analysis, but it can't be the focus.
First of all, I really do think we need to, since this has all the language except an addition of one paragraph, of one section, which incidentally I don't think is a problem, I think we need to take the other amendment out. I'm not sure about that. What amendment does this amend?
Mr. Chair, members, this you adopted the dash 61 amendments, which contain the provisions of Senate Bill 455. That amendment actually is identical to what you have in front of you, with the exception of what Representative Maurer commented on page 2, lines 11 through 22. And like we have done in the past, you may want to undo the 61 if you adopt this amendment.
I think we may need to. Let's see if we can get some advice on it. Rick, do you know? Roxy, do you know? This is an amendment. We adopted the 61. This has exactly everything that was in the 61s, but an additional paragraph. If we pass this, do we need to rescind the 61s?
LC will merge the line.
Yeah, LC's going to have enough job to do anyway. Okay, we have a motion before us from Representative Maurer to adopt the A75s. You want to have any more discussion
right
before
here.
We go on?
No, I'm willing to.
Representative Kotek?
I was just wondering if Dr. Smith has any comment on this.
I heard from Dr. Smith's shop that they don't have a major problem with
this.
Come and talk to us.
Chair Greenlake, members of the committee, Janine Smith, Administrator, Office of Health Policy and Research.
we'll get you a little sign.
we just saw this a couple hours ago. We're not sure if we're... Either way, it does say patient-centered review. Most of the reviews are clinician-centered. You could get into, systematic reviews isn't listed, but there's permissive language that says may consider. My only concern is we didn't definitely decide this in our bill because we left it to, comparative effectiveness could be defined differently 5 years from now, 10 years from now, and so does this box us in, is the only question that I, when I talked to my director of the Health Resources Commission, was his concern, does this prevent us from using doing meta-analyses, because it's not specifically outlined here. I think since it says may consider, it may be all right. So those were just, I mean, I just don't know that it is a bad thing, but it, I can't say absolutely. We get our reviews through a multi-state consortium and through national studies, and so if a national study didn't fit this criteria, would we not be able to use it? But it may be a semantic problem.
Janine, let me ask you a question. It seems to me the key issue here is on line 15.
Yep. Where it says
the
cost.
The focus is not cost containment.
Right.
I mean, is there a primary focus of research?
Chair Greenlee, I think there are in the economic world, health economics world, there's sort of the whole qualies things as we discussed the other day. The Resource Commission does a comprehensive systematic review of what all is out there and consolidate, you know, that's what we get, that's what we purchase as a multi-state of this exhaustive review. There may be some of those studies that look at it from a cost perspective, but they're not primarily necessarily, not all the studies are primarily focused on cost containment. They may talk about cost, which I think he addresses here, risks, benefits, and cost. As long as the primary focus is not cost containment.
But does this language...
Senator Harker?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Some may be primarily focused on cost containment.
That might be captured in a comprehensive...
those, right?
Well, that's what I was just making sure that the language is, allows us to still keep our ability to do the comprehensive reviews.
Mr. Chair, you know, if I may, when... Representative Harker, I'm sorry, when Representative Maurer presented this, he used the word soul, you know, soul focus. And, you know, that I would be more comfortable with. Primary focus seems kind of squishy to me. And I think, you know, we may have studies where, you know, the primary focus might be on cost containment, but there would be other significant factors as well, which would be looked at, and so that I'm uncomfortable with.
Mr. Chair,
as a researcher, yes, please.
I just had a clarifying question, and it's probably repetitive. Sorry, but I just want to be sure this doesn't displace any of the cost containment language we have put in the bill. It's simply an additional thing we want the commission to do.
Here is my point. First off, this definition wasn't picked up from any Google search. It was an amalgamation of different people's views on what comparative research is and what it isn't. And then LC took my language and changed it around. So I'm seeing it, you know, really for the first time also. The point is that if you start to look at human life valued only in a dollar sense and not and the treatment only in a dollar sense, at some point the issues of quality of life disappear. It becomes very political instead of clinical outcomes. Instead of outcomes-based research versus some sort of subjective, I think it gets worse in the conversation of what we're looking at and what we're looking for. And the way this bill reads, it says the Health Resources Commission shall conduct comparative effectiveness research. To me, that means they're conducting the research. And you're saying they're not conducting the research. To me, research is not Googling. It is conducting, studies, control.
Let me address this, if I might, Representative Maurer, as a researcher now, not as a policy person. And I would say to you as a researcher, I never do any research based on the outcome I want, or at least I mostly don't. I think cost-effectiveness research has definition in the art, and it is looking at effectiveness in terms of cost and in terms of other kinds of things. And the person that commissioned me to do this may want the results in order to achieve cost containment. But as a researcher, I'm just doing research. But I frequently will come up with a finding like ones I remember from my tobacco research, the cost of saving a life by investing in group smoking cessation, which will get a 20% outcome to get people to quit smoking, versus investing in a public health campaign that will only get 1 in 1,000 people to quit smoking by my campaign, but the cost for life saved when I then run it out can be 100 times more in a public campaign than investing in one-to-one or group smoking cessation. Now, was the purpose of that for cost containment? Well, some people would use it for cost containment. Other people would say how to invest your money. But the only problem I have with this language, and I like everything except that phrase pretty much, although there are definitions that include other things, and there's now must be a federal definition of cost of this term, right, since they're just putting $1.2 billion into this term, is that this might add ambiguity to a situation that otherwise doesn't have ambiguity. What is the purpose of this research? Not what outcomes will you get, anything, but basically, why did you undertake it?
Yes, sir. Another question for Representative Maurer. I just was looking at subsection 4 on the top of page 2, where it's the amendment provides that the PEB and the OEB shall pursue healthcare purchasing strategies that adopt the research findings described in subsection 1. Does that mean that they would be instructed to pursue purchasing strategies based on this research at the expense of research or findings that are based on cost containment? Is that
No, that language is already in the one we adopted.
Right. It is?
We've adopted.
Yeah, but
It's
still a legitimate question. It's still an important question. But
here, let me give you an example. And I used it this morning in Human Services. And it's about smoking, whether or not smoking saves money. And there's a study that's published in New England Journal of Medicine in 1996.
Whether smoking saves money.
Whether smoking saves money.
Yeah, it does.
And you were there. You heard that? No.
Somebody else. I believe that Dr. Cohn
was there. The point is that at the end of the day, if it's only about cost, then you say, folks, light them up, because ultimately it's going to save our system
He's
money.
Defining it.
But that isn't the question. The question is quality. I mean, there's quality of life. You know, there's short-term benefits, cost. And you know, from an intuitive standpoint, you go, well, no, you don't want people to smoke, even though ultimately it's going to save us money. But if you start making your decisions solely on whether or not you're going to save the system money, then I think your focus is wrong.
But the question is it a system that's doing this, or is it the research that's doing this? I mean, somebody can take... I mean, I think the research you're talking about was, I think, in the American Journal of Public Health, and it talked about how if everybody quit smoking, it would bust Social Security because people would live long enough to collect Social Security benefits.
Well, that would be
benefits.
Another one.
It ultimately saved money because everybody died soon. But having done that research, it doesn't mean that I did that research in order for cost containment. But I'm going to vote against this amendment, even though I think it adds confusion rather than clarity to the situation, and I certainly believe that the definitions I hope that you'll take of what comparative effectiveness research takes into consideration, cost, quality of life, all the other factors that are here.
Right.
It isn't just a Google search.
Comparative effectiveness is a politically loaded term that has a lot of baggage. And so all I'm saying is I'm trying to keep us away from that, address this issue so that it doesn't become the political bank. It showed up in the testimony for Governor Sebelius in her confirmation.
Existing paragraph.
And just either yesterday or day before yesterday, correct?
Yes.
So, I mean, this is a politically loaded term, and I think we can avoid that with some rational. I'm not suggesting that this is the perfect definition of trespass, but I am saying it's please beware.
If we had time, I would say we can monkey around with this, but this bill's going out.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, ma'am.
I really appreciate Representative Maurer's intent here. I just want to clarify, this is a Senate bill, right?
Yeah.
Chair Greenleaf, Representative Kotek, this is the Senate bill that you adopted with the addition of that Section 6 that actually puts the definition of comparative effectiveness into the bill.
So the one we did pass, which was the dash 61s, was Senate Bill 455.
Which was what was passed by the Senate.
Which was worked by the Senate. And did that leave the Senate committee unanimously?
Yes, it did.
Thank you.
As far as I remember, yes.
Well,
they actually added language to from the original bill that they, you know, in Section 4. And that, to my recollection at this moment in time, it was unanimous.
Okay. Can we have a roll call?
The motion here is to...
The motion
okay.
is to adopt A-75.
Right.
Representative Devereaux?
No.
Vice Chair Harker? No. Representative Kennemer? Aye. Representative Kotek? No. Vice Chair Maurer? Aye. Representative Thompson? Aye. Representative Bruin? Aye. Representative Cannon? No. Chair Greenleaf? No.
The motion fails. This question should have failed 6-4 or 5-5.
Right.
Okay. Can we stand at ease for a moment? We're off trying to get the final bureaucratic authorizations we need to.
So, Mr. Chair, are we going to move it without a fiscal?
We have a pass to Ways and Means, since it has to go to Ways and Means.
Okay.
No, they've given us an indeterminate fiscal and says we'll worry about it there.
Okay.
It's not going to. I mean, obviously, it won't go to the House if it comes
understand.
Out of Ways and Means. What we're waiting for is a revenue to look at the amendments to make sure after they approved taking out the fact that it had revenue, we didn't sneak any revenue back into
right.
it.
But my understanding is, regardless of what Ways and Means says, we still have to have a fiscal in order to pass it. Oh, we do have one.
We do have one. It's an indeterminate fiscal.
But we have a fiscal statement.
Yeah, we have a fiscal statement which says it's okay to pass it on. It says...
The fiscal was based on, I guess I haven't seen the fiscal.
It's basically amounts to a hall pass, saying that fiscal issues will be taken up in Ways and Means.
In Ways and Means.
Okay.
But they didn't want to do the analysis until they got the final thing and got the time on it, so it'll get lots of attention in Ways and Means, I'm assured. Can we open up a work session on where did I lost it? The psychologist bill is the one I want. What's that?
2702.
2702.
I won't count on anything.
On 2702. Let's open up a work session on 2702. Would you guide us through this, Madam Administrator, please?
Yes. this is the bill that we, that the committee passed the Dash 3 amendment on, and we're ready to move it out. And Representative Thompson realized that there was a small glitch in the certification. And so Representative Kenemer very quickly got us an amendment, which is the Dash 5 amendment. We had the Dash, we had a fiscal on the Dash 3, and this is a very technical amendment. And so we can move it out with a suspension of the rules. And the Dash 5 amendment you have in front of you at the dais, it was also sent to you electronically.
Representative Kenemer, you want to help us on this one, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The Dash 3 amendments,
well, what they do is...
the Dash what?
Dash 5.
Pardon me. The Dash 5 amendments correct the two items that were brought to our attention on Monday. One is that we had the medical board as the credentialing authority, and it needs to be a national accrediting board, it should read. So we had that attribution to the wrong item. The second is there was a statement about a degree in clinical pharmacology, and we wanted to correct it so that it reads correctly, postdoctoral master's degree in clinical psychopharmacology.
Do you have a motion on those amendments?
Yes, I would move approval of the Dash 5 amendments to House Bill 2702.
Let's do it. Representative Kenemer, move the addition of the Dash 5 amendments dated 4-2209. To House Bill 2702.
Okay, now we need to suspend the rules, and we have a script for that.
We have to adopt the amendment.
We have to adopt the amendment.
We just adopted the amendment.
No, we have a motion for the amendment.
Oh, excuse me. I'm sorry.
Is there any discussion of that motion?
I'm sorry.
Is there any objection? Dash 5s. Okay.
Okay, so
Administrator?
Mr. Chair, I move the rules be suspended for the purpose of voting on House Bill 2702 as amended without the fiscal and revenue impact statements being available for review.
Is the revenue statement available?
No.
Okay.
I mean, we have both a revenue and a fiscal on the Dash 3. I did not request the one on the Dash 3.
And I'm putting on the record that there's no reason to believe that the Dash 5s in any way change fiscal or revenue, so we're asking for a suspension of the rules so we can move it forward with the existing fiscal and revenue. Is there any discussion on that? Would you call the roll? This is a suspension of the rules.
Representative Garrett?
Aye.
Vice Chair Harper?
Aye.
Representative
Kramer? Aye.
Representative Kotek?
Aye.
Vice Chair Maher?
Aye.
Representative Thompson?
Aye.
Representative Bruin?
Aye.
Representative Cannon?
Aye.
Representative
Debrow?
Aye.
Chair
Greenick? Aye. Suspension of the rules passes. Would you give us a motion on the bill as amended, please, Representative Kenemer?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move House Bill 2702 as amended to the floor. Is that right? To the floor with the due pass recommendation.
And this... I do need to say to the committee, as a close friend has said to me, we're all good Americans, vote your conscience on this one. I've not done much of a vote count, so it will move as it moves.
And there's other bills that have been counted.
Theory as the basis of the count.
Oh.
Two of mine that will go forward. That will not go forward today. Based on doing that.
I'm fine with it, but I'm curious.
And I do want to support this. I think I've heard all the testimony. I'm convinced that a psychologist with a 2-year postdoctoral master's degree in psychopharmacology is going to be, and under the restrictions of the bill, which there are restrictions in that, in the prescribing pattern, will be a safe and useful addition to the healthcare system. There are others here, I think, who are more cautious about that. Yes.
Mr. Chair, I will be a no on this bill today, and I was a yes in 2007 when a similar bill came forward, and I'm not doing this merely to be able to say to the psychologists in my district, see, I voted for your bill
in 2007,
and I'm voting against your bill. Say to the psychiatrist, see, I'm voting no on your bill or on their bill in 2009. So I'm not just trying to have it both ways. I think it actually reflects the the challenge that this kind of bill presents a committee like this one, and certainly in particular I would say that sort of non-medically trained members of this committee, I feel at somewhat of a disadvantage in that respect, and it harkens to mind for me the bill we had that was not successful last session that would have dealt with these scope of practice issues in a very different way. It would have set up a process to bring forward recommendations to the legislature that hopefully would have come forward in a consensual manner and could have been worked out beforehand. That was not the case here, although I know there was an effort at that. And I think there's considerable disagreement, certainly, about whether this is the right step to take, and very strong feelings on both sides, and I will be a no, but I feel no more strongly about my no today than I did about my yes. It's a very tough call.
Representative Brewer.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Cannon expresses my sentiments spot on. I also voted yes for this 2 years ago. I'm going to vote no today. My hesitation is not a non-acknowledgement, if you will, of the need. There's a serious need which this bill is attempting to address. My biggest consideration, in line with what Representative Cannon articulated, is the fact that we have to sit here as citizen legislator, non-medical professionals, at least in my particular example, of having to listen to one group of healthcare providers tell us something, and me having to say they don't know what they're talking about or they're wrong. I mean, one case in point is just the letter that we received on Monday from the Oregon Pediatric Society, which says that they're in fervent opposition and outline their reasons, and I have to be in a position of saying no, you're wrong, and I'm just not comfortable with that position.
Others? Yes, sir.
Jim was first.
I'm sorry, Representative Thompson.
I have a concern about this bill that it doesn't do what we want it to do. It just came up yesterday. We have a couple of places in there where it requires psychiatrists to come to the table and serve on boards or to approve the work of a prescribing child psychologist. With the input I've received, I'm afraid that's not going to happen. And what we've done is we've inadvertently taken, no matter where you are on this bill, yes or no, we've taken the bill and put it in the hands of the psychiatric community to make the decision on whether or not they're going to cooperate, which, if they don't cooperate, we don't fulfill the intention of the bill. I think it needs something in here to get these people to work together and see if they can come to some agreements, which I don't think they are in agreement. I think passing it is not going to get us prescribing for psychologists. It's going to get us involved in the middle of a turf battle, because there's nothing in here that says that these two communities will sit down and work together. I'm sort of trending toward, I think it's a good idea to have the bill, but I think we may have inadvertently put something in the bill that's going to keep that from happening.
So, Kontek, you led an effort in the last session to try and get somewhere, and part of my belief is that we're never going to get consensus on this, that this is a win or lose, you win, I lose situation. Would you comment on your efforts the last time?
I'd be happy to, Mr. Chair. Well, I'm smiling over here because anytime we discuss scope of practice, we are, frankly, by default, walking into a turf war. I would point out that the Psychological Association, freely and voluntarily wanted to be first in line to take advantage of Senator Monis Anderson's efforts in the interim around a scope of practice discussion. And I apologize if I haven't. I'm not sure I have. I'm not sure I've seen a psychiatrist's response to the psychologist, but they did fill out the form. They've made a good faith effort to meet with the other side. This is an improved bill from 2007. I think it's even stronger. I think there's been attempt to have discussion. And I think at some point you are not going to have consensus. And I think due diligence has been done on this bill. Can we say 100% sure that nothing is going to go wrong? No, but I don't think we can say that on any of our bills. I think we make educated guesses every time we come and vote on bills. And I think, well, I know I'm comfortable with the bill. I think this addresses issues out there. for folks with mental health issues who need access to providers in different communities. It is not the answer to all our access issues, but I think it's a strong start. I don't anticipate, you know, the stampede of psychologists wanting to take advantage of this new option. But for the ones who want to and the ones who are supported by their primary care physicians in their communities, I think we need to get it on the books. So I'm a full supportive yes.
Representative Garrett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will be a barely a no vote on the bill. This has been the hardest bill for me the entire session to figure out what I'm going to do. It's a very close call. I associate myself with the comments of Representatives Bruin and Cannon. I do recognize that this gets into turf, but I don't, maybe I'm just too new here and too naive, but I prefer to think people are acting in good faith. And from where I sit, I think the parties are. I see the psychologists believing in good faith this is good policy. I think the psychiatrists believe in good faith this is potentially dangerous. And for me, recognizing that this has been a very carefully crafted bill, I appreciate the work Representative Kotek has done. I respect the views of the licensed psychologist to my left. But I, if I knew what they know, I might have the comfort level that I need to vote yes on this bill. But I only know what I know. And based on what I know, I'm not comfortable making this change right now, so I'll be a no vote.
Any other discussion?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will be supporting this bill, but my my anxiety over it perfectly mirrors Representative Garrett's, although I'm just slightly on the yes side. And I think actually this is an issue that has really found the middle for many of us. That is, people are slightly support, slightly opposed, because the psychiatrists have certainly raised issues that give pause. But as I've thought this through, I'm very appreciative of the process that's been gone through to come up with the bill in the form that it is. I think it covers so many concerns, and I think that it is really consistent with the core principles of what we're trying to do here in healthcare reform in terms of getting people to to work at the top of their licensure, increasing access to rural areas of the state, and I think the safeguards in it are adequate for me, so therefore I'm going to support it.
Could you call the roll, please?
Mr. Chair,
I'm sorry. Yes.
Oh, you haven't. But I just have a question, not because I want to derail this. I don't have a copy of the Dash 3 fiscal, and I want to make sure we actually did get it, because I don't want us to have to come back and have someone yell at us. I don't think there's a problem with it. I think it's fine. That was it? Just minimal? Okay. Thank you.
Yes, sir. Mr. Vice Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just like my colleagues here, I've gone back and forth, just to preserve the suspense. I will be voting on this issue.
If you leave now, we'll do a call of the House and get you back. Would you call the roll, please?
Vice Chair Harker?
Aye.
Representative Kennemer?
Aye.
Representative Kotek?
Aye.
Vice Chair Maurer?
Aye.
Representative Thompson?
Aye.
Representative Bruin?
Present.
And accounted for it, but not yet, right?
No.
Representative Cannon?
No.
Representative Dembrough?
Aye.
Representative Garrett?
No.
Chair Greenlee?
Aye. The motion carries. Would you carry it to the floor, Dr. Kennemer?
Would you like to? I wonder also, Representative Kotek has put a lot of work into this. I wonder if we should go.
I think you should carry it, Representative, and I'd be happy to speak.
I'd be delighted. Thank you.
You get Representative Barnhart to help you if you want. Okay. Motion carries. motion passes. Let me do a couple of work things. I want to carry over House Bill 2925 until Friday. We don't have what we need to. Is that right? We don't have what we need to work it today.
2925.
Ah, we could work. All right. Let me pull it back. Let's not do that yet. That's okay, huh?
Yeah, that's the 90-day description.
Where'd everybody go?
Suspense.
Okay, we'll get him back in a minute. It is my intention not to carry forward, for any of you that cares, we will not carry forward House Bill 2967, the Behavioral Science Research Task Force Group, and we will not carry forward House Bill 2057, which is the bill that removes semi-independent status of the three boards. Let's see if there's anything else that I want to let die. Not yet. Well, do we have the ability? You can add, but I won't hammer.
About 21-22, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, that's exactly where I want to go now. In fact, but what I want to do is move 21-22 to revenue. Do we need any further thing to move it to revenue?
No, we have both indeterminate fiscal and an indeterminate revenue.
Okay. My intention is we don't have time to play around with it. There's a lot of work to be done. I'm not getting clear enough answers from the model, so I would like to move it. Should I wait for the other folks to come back, or do I have enough votes?
You moving it without recommendation?
Without recommendation.
Who was that? We can move it.
Okay. Can I have a motion to move House Bill 2122 to revenue? Without recommendation.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2122 to the Committee on Revenue with no recommendation.
Is there any discussion? Any objection? Moves to revenue. We have everything we need to move. Yes.
Were Representative Parker and Representative Kenemer both excused?
They were excused. The rest were yes. We wanted to move 2552, but it turns out we have a fiscal that has a very significant fiscal component to it, and we will obviously, as a result of that, need to move it to Ways and Means. We do want to move it to Ways and Means, at least I do, but we need authorization to do that, is that right? So let me carry forward House Bill 2552 and we'll carry it forward to Friday, and with any luck at all, we'll have an authorization to move it on to Ways and Means. Is everybody here? Somebody find Mr. Kenemer? Dr. Kenemer, or Representative Kenemer? I want to, if he's just outside. I want to open a work session on House Bill 2009A. Can I have a motion on House Bill 2009A, please?
I think we need a drum roll, not a motion. Mr. Chair, I move 2009A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation with a rescission of the prior referral to the Revenue Committee and a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Is there any discussion? Final comment.
With or without recommendation, Mr. Chair?
With due pass recommendation.
With the due pass recommendation.
Let me make a final comment, and anybody else can. We've worked very hard on this, and all of the committee members have been pretty impressive. All the administrative staff, the committee administration staff has worked hard on this. Rick, Roxy, and Sandy have done an incredible job. The LCs have been amazing. What was the final amendment? The dash 74 was the final amendment.
Well, actually, dash 75.
Well, dash 74 was the final amendment we adopted to it, but dash 75. We had tons of amendments. I personally want to say I worked very hard to try and work with all the interest groups in it who had an opinion, and there were tons of them. And I also worked very hard to try and get every member of the committee's voice in this. I think everybody here will find things in it that they had something to say about. I hope as many of you as possible can find it that the product came out well enough so you can support it. It's got a long path yet, but it's been very satisfying. Any other comments? Yes, ma'am.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to thank the thousands of Oregonians who participated in the Oregon Health Fund Board process.
Yep.
All those folks who attended the gazillion advisory meetings, the town hall meetings. I think we have made an attempt with 2009 to the best of our ability, with all political ramifications and other things considered, to produce a bill that is true to the recommendations of the Oregon Health Fund Board. To move the next step here in Oregon in terms of health care reform. We started this discussion almost 4 years ago now that culminated with Senate Bill 329 in 2007. I think we have made a very strong effort to stay true to those recommendations based on mounds of input and feedback and staff work. And though not perfect, I think especially with the inclusion of the Senate bills, we have a full, conclusive, comprehensive package that I hope all the folks here could support. I'm not guessing we'll get everyone's support, but I think it's a testament to the process, and I look forward to getting it in ways and means.
Thank you, Representative Kotek.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, sir.
I want to thank you for what I think has been an effort at an inclusive process, and it's been an interesting odyssey for me to come back after originally the Oregon Health Plan started out in days when I was here. And it was a slightly different debate and a similar debate. And it's been an interesting experience to try to get up to speed and to grasp what is such a complex bill and a situation. I think it borders on being a noble effort, and I say that with kind of a special reverence and feeling about it. I have fears and concerns, but I have questions about the tons of amendments. I think I'm past numbers. I'm at tons now. And I don't know for sure how they all read when you put them in the context. But I appreciate concessions that were made regarding DCBS. The exchange, I think there were some nice changes in the exchange. Private insurance was included. I think some work was done on the authority to make it a much better, more functional, and from my perspective, acceptable piece. I suspect it's not flawless, and I'm worried about what it costs and how we really make it work, but at this point, I'm prepared to support it, and I appreciate the effort to get it to this point.
Representative Harker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Not having been in on any of the previous debates and having come into this at this point in time has been an inspiring and daunting task. It has been greatly comforting to have the work, for me, to have the work of the Health Fund Board to follow and to fall back on for advice as we went through this. And as I've said to several of the people out here before, I have hoped that this bill would become a bright spot in this session, and at a time where there are some long faces and some serious concerns about what we're going to be able to accomplish this session, That remains one of my sincere hopes. I feel like we have had great conversation about it, a lot of good give and take, and I'm happy to be passing it out of here, and I hope it will move through the Senate in good time. Thank you.
This is health care reform, and it's not the direction that I would take it. And I just want to thank you, though, for the process.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, thanks, Mr. Chair. I want to echo some of the things that Representative Kenemer said, although with a heavy heart, sort of come up with a different outcome for me. I appreciate this. I've never seen anything like it in my legislative career, the work and the effort on this committee, all done in a good faith effort. And, Mr. Chair, you said something I hope I can repeat publicly, because I think it's a strong testament to you. It could have been the first week of session, I don't recall, but you said that you were hoping, something of the fact that you were hoping and expecting all of us would work in a good faith effort, even if that means at the end of the day you still couldn't support the bill. And that's sort of where I am. I think this bill is light years better than it was when it hit our desks on January 10th or January 12th, whatever the day was. I'm proud of the work that this committee has done. I think it was a whole new model of a working, a truly working committee, even to the point where we're sitting facing each other and the action, the give and take that went with that. I think that on a piecemeal basis, there is so much of House Bill 2009 where it stands right today, which is excellent policy and the way we have to go. And so it is with a heavy heart that I'm going to vote no. I do it with great humility and absolutely no pride whatsoever. It's just, Mr. Chair, the issues of the authority, the exchange, and the new state insurance program, and what that does both from a cost perspective and what it does from a power perspective, and truly, and what I see is a large aggrandizement of power away from the private and into the public, and I don't think power exists in a vacuum. I think when it leaves one place, it goes someplace else, and I think we're potentially tipping the balance too far on the side of public versus private. So it's with all that, and once again, a strong acknowledgement and gratitude for the work of this committee. I appreciate it. It's been a great experience, and thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Mr. Thompson?
Well, I have concerns about this bill. I think we've done what we set out to do partially. And I think it's been a great effort, and it's going in generally the right direction. My problem is the lack of definition. I'm very concerned about turning this over to a health care authority board at this point with a very, very large budget attached to it, and then telling them to go out and do good things. To me, it harkens back to the SAFE experience of, we built that over a very long time into a first-rate organization that still has some problems, but it's well-supported by its clients. This, to me, is going from zero to today at SAFE and trying to do it in one step without definition. I'm a little concerned that we're going to build a bureaucracy that is going to not deliver health care, but is going to deliver a whole lot of government intervention, and there goes our $1 billion off the table in Washington into a large bureaucracy. I think you said it yourself, Mr. Chair, that this could take up half of DHS. And that in itself scares me, because that many people interacting in this process too soon toward building this thing, I think, would be a real impediment. I would rather see us take the highlights of this, develop them incrementally over the next 2 years, and launch them toward somewhere down the line. We pull it together into the health authority, which, by the way, I do not like the term health authority. That sounds like the health Gestapo to me. but that's not reason to oppose the bill. So I will be voting no today, but I don't want that to be misconstrued as I don't support health care reform, because we have to do something. We cannot continue down the line that we're in, because very soon health care in this country is going to equal the gross national product, at which time we're in trouble. So we have to do something, but I don't think this is the proper instrument to launch at this time.
Thank you. I do want to put two things on the record I have to in response to this. First of all, this does not create a large government bureaucracy. In fact, it divides a very large government bureaucracy into two smaller bureaucracies. And I also want to put on the record that there is no specific definition here of an exchange or a public organization or anything, and that we will have the opportunity to come back and vote on those things in 2011. But, Mr. Burns, will you join us at the front table, please?
See, I'm starting in the beginning and go through it. Just one more time.
Section by section.
Now,
please, section
by section. Page one. Can we talk about that? No, I just think it would be good for you to be here during this. Can we have a roll call, please?
Representative Kotek?
Aye.
Vice Chair Maurer?
No.
Representative Thompson?
No.
Representative Bruin?
No.
Representative Cannon?
Aye.
Representative Dimbrough?
Aye.
Representative Garrett?
Aye.
Vice Chair Harker?
Aye.
Representative Kinnemer?
Aye.
Chair Greenlee?
Aye. Motion carries, and House Bill 2009A is on its way to the Committee on Ways and Means. Thank you all. Okay. Keep working. I think I did not announce I want to carry over House Bill 2117, and that will be carried over until Friday.
Mm-hmm. I'm carrying that over. Just keep the waiting clause alive in case you need it, and then we'll probably send it on to you in case you need it. It's really need the help.
3418.
Yeah.
Okay.
Are there people here to talk about 3418?
Yes. The answer is yes.
You want to join us up here? Do we have some amendments on 3418? Roxy, would you tell us about it, please?
Actually, I think Martin is probably in a better position to talk about them than I am. We received them today. I haven't had a chance to look at them.
So we're not prepared to move it, but we could bring the amendments in, and then that will help us get a...
Right. We don't have a FISP on this.
Okay.
Do you want
to join them?
No, that's fine.
Okay.
You're good, gentlemen.
Go for it. Chair Greenlee, members of the committee, thank you for your time on this issue. When we last visited with you and did a public hearing on the bill, I think you got a pretty good understanding of the intent, which was to change gradually change our system of paying for primary care from one based almost exclusively on intervening when illness occurs to one that's almost exclusively based on trying to prevent illness from taking place in the first place. It's a shift to population health model. You had some folks in that process who expressed concerns. You directed us to go find amendments that will help address those concerns. I don't want to speak for any other organizations. I will say that we've done our homework and come up with amendments that we believe are responsive to the concerns we heard. Since these amendments were just available to you at the beginning of this hearing, I think it's appropriate to say those folks have not all gotten back and let us know that now that they've seen them in written form, it works. But we believe that what we submitted to Legislative Council was responsive to those concerns, and this ought to do it. So that's where we're at this stage in the process. And if you'd like us to go through each of those changes, we could try to do that. Or if you're satisfied that there is a due diligence, we could bring these in, and then we know that we have at least one more opportunity before you once the fiscal arrives.
Do we have those amendments, Roxy?
No, we received them just before. And I have a copy here. Someone would like to see them, but we don't.
Which amendments are we talking about?
The dash two.
I think we do have the
dash. We have.
Okay, good. Yeah. Great.
Would you lead us through those, please?
Okay. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
We'll do.
You guys lead us through.
And I'm going to try to hit the highlights because there's a lot of these things that are specific words for specific folks.
The complete gut and stuff?
Yes, it is, sir.
Okay. So we just need to look at the amendment.
Right. In Section 1, the term that we settled upon with all groups feeling comfortable and actually some direction from legislators was to term these primary care homes rather than integrated health homes. That change has been incorporated throughout the bill. The second thing that was important to folks was that we, in describing a primary care home, had language that was a little looser so that folks that were making efforts in these directions but couldn't necessarily meet each of these elements could participate. So instead of saying must have at least the following elements in line 10 in the amendments, you'll see, I'm sorry, on page 3, you'll see it now says that promote at least the following elements. And that phrase promote takes care of people's concerns. In each of these elements, there have been some small changes. I would say that the gist of those changes is pretty consistently to make the language a little softer or a little bit more acceptable for folks that felt like they needed more latitude. For example, and there's a number of those changes, but for example, in Section 1, Sub D 19, it says behavioral health providers are integrated into primary care delivery systems but are not necessarily in the same location as physical health services. Just making that change to say not in the same location was the kind of things that eased concerns. I guess rather than going through each of the elements, each of the changes, because there's plenty of them, I'm going to stop at the end of Section 1 right now and just say, are there other questions on Section 1 or things that you'd like to hear about that you want to include? Yes. So,
that's the imperative provider.
Section 2 is a pretty critical piece, and that is really responsive to feedback that we heard from Jim Edge and the folks at DHS about the best way to go about doing this without incurring a fiscal impact in the 2009-2011 biennium, and to give them the best direction on how to proceed. So with this language, isn't exactly what we were, this is what we could agree with legislative counsel was appropriate for statute and gave us the guidance that DHS needed to try to avoid a fiscal. And we hope we've accomplished that, but I guess we'll find out when we get a fiscal. And it says, no later than June 30, 2010, DHS will report to the appropriate interim committees of the Legislative Assembly on the feasibility of implementation of a system for reimbursement for health care delivered through primary care homes in the Medicaid program. This answers a question that Representative Kotek raised, which is this Medicaid only? It allows you to move into a place where you're looking at the feasibility of doing things, but you're not actually paying differently in this biennium. It should allow us in the 2011 biennium to have a changed payment system, and it won't in any way prohibit organizations like Care Oregon that are already using some different models from continuing to use those different models. And the last thing I want to touch on is Section 3D, which was a question of at the point where we've developed incentives, what would the incentives for learning collaboratives look like? And I think we now have incentives to participate in learning collaboratives as an effort to land on an environment where the providers that are actually doing these services are the ones that are helping create a report to you in June of 2010. And there are also the community of folks that will be reporting back to the from that process back to the legislature on how to continue to develop this new payment method. That as a collection of interests and often represented by their lobbyists, we bring a degree of policy expertise to this process, but we do believe that there are providers doing this that through a learning collaborative environment could do an even better job of describing what the future of primary care looks like than folks like us. So we believe that next time you hear this topic in your next legislative session, it will be coming from the folks that are actually in the field doing it, which we are certainly have folks in the field doing it, but that's an important component. The learning collaborative is an important component.
You reviewed the dash issues. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Doug Riggs, Oregon Primary Care Association. I don't have any particular comments other than to add that, as we mentioned before, this is really where the rubber meets the road for healthcare reform, and we did make a significant effort to meet with all the interested parties. We sat down with them on several occasions and been exchanging emails back and forth, and I believe that this addresses most of the concerns that were expressed at the hearing.
Is there any opposition to it? Is there anybody out there who wants a, who has a problem with it? Senator Maurer, do you have a comment on it? You've been sort of leading in this direction.
No, actually, I don't. It's an issue of getting the parties together. I still say our health care reform is about reforming the payment system, and you change it and they will come. You have to change it somewhere, and it's the best place to start.
Mr. Chair,
I
have a comment on these. I'm looking at the dash twos for the first time, and I appreciate the work that you've done to try to bring consensus around this bill. But with all due respect to that process, and notwithstanding what I said earlier when we had psychiatrists and psychologists unable to reach consensus and the frustration that or challenge that created for us, I think this is one place where the legislature should be willing to step into the fray and say, you know what, there is a better way to do it, and here it is. And the, you know, with respect to what Doug said, I'm not sure the rubber does meet the road on these dash twos. And I'm looking at changes here that include a definition that requires the primary care homes to promote the following elements rather than include the following elements. I'm looking at changes that say the DHS shall report on a system, the feasibility of implementation of a system for reimbursement, not promote the language originally in section one sub two said a system for reimbursement of health care that encourages and rewards the use of these integrated health homes. That encourages and rewards isn't in the dash twos. Now, I haven't been part of those conversations that took place between you and other stakeholders, and I understand the way this process works politically and the advantage that you bring when you meet in the hallway and work it out and come to us with language that nobody's screaming about. But I guess for the record and for the future, this is a place where I believe legislators ought to be willing to step up, take a stand, and say, you know what, there's a better way to do it, and we know that. And I come to that sharing Representative Maurer's conviction about reforming payment systems and what that can mean for more effective, lower cost, higher quality outcomes. So I think it's a comment for the record and for the future more than this bill.
Well, but we can not accept the dash twos and move the original bill. If that's the interest.
The other piece, which I wasn't meaning to address, was this issue of the fiscal and the current budget crisis, right? And to at least some of these changes were motivated by a desire to avoid additional costs. And that's the reality of you know, the fact we have $4 billion less money than we'll need in order to fund existing programs. So I get that and want to support this effort by ensuring there's a way to move forward even in light of that that challenge.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Cannon, let me just make a quick point, which is the bill as drafted was a voluntary program in any event. It remains a voluntary program, and I think the language changes that we've made will make people more comfortable that they won't be forced into something. But I do think that you're going to have some major organizations stepping up during the interim working with DHS. CARE Oregon and the OPCA have already been working together on this same type of thing, and I think what the bill will do is it will incentivize and give people a forum to step up to the plate. Try to come up with programs that actually do have a significant impact as far as numbers of people impacted and number of patients who are going to be able to go through this new system. So I hope to be able to come back in the next session and say we had 35 different, you know, providers with, along with insurers, working on these, you know, 50 different programs, and they all brought back some good information. So I agree, in an ideal world, we could say this is exactly how you're going to do it. But I think sometimes maybe giving some guidance and flexibility makes people a little less leery, and maybe more people will be willing to volunteer from the start.
Representative Kotick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Congratulations on getting to this point. I have a question of whether or not you've probably been following the Senate Bill 456 discussion. Conflicts with 456? Complementary? Oh. In sync? You're defining some things. We asked them to define some things.
If I may, I think that's a great question. We feel very good about both bills.
Excuse me. Have you ever said to a legislator, that's a dumb question?
Mr. Well, you know, I promise.
Just checking. I'm sorry.
No.
I do ask questions occasionally.
Most of the people involved in this bill are working through a group that was also involved in the other bill, and I don't want to represent each of them, but I'd say collectively there is a great deal of support for both. The question about where they intersect is... right now you have slightly different names on these two things, which isn't necessarily a problem. This is a system for payment that creates a statutory definition for a system, and the other sets up a work group to help describe the elements of something that you could say is very similar. But you might want to ask someone at UPR or DMAP who's going to be making the effort to implement those things, but I don't think of those names as necessarily going to create a conflict in getting the responsibilities done. They both also refer to a learning collaborative, but this was a learning collaborative around payment, and that's more a learning collaborative around the delivery of and promotion of integrated, well, what we're no longer calling integrated health homes, patient-centered primary care home in that case. So complementary efforts. I think it's entirely fair to say that you could take both bills and stick them into one bill and they would be a full package. As it is, I think what you've got are two pieces of a similar package in two different places but complement each other.
These are drafted today, the amendments.
Mm-hmm.
We just got these?
That's right.
I'm inclined to think there aren't any problems. I don't know if it makes any sense to...
Just carry it over.
Well, we've just included Senate Bill 456 in 2009. I don't think there's a problem. I don't, mm-hmm. but...
We have to carry this.
I would look to the rest of the committee if they feel like they need to do a comparison. I don't think the name's an issue.
Mm-hmm.
I think you're probably right. I don't know. Did the Office of Health Policy and Research look at these? They did not. I just wouldn't want us to get somewhere and then have someone tell us, oh, you know what, there's a conflict, because I support what we put into 2009 and your bill, but I don't want to have us at odds.
Let's carry it over and deal with the amendments and everything on Friday. That makes sense?
Yeah.
Do we need to move the dash twos?
To get a fiscal? No, we can get a fiscal on the dash twos. We will ask for fiscal on the dash twos.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just think we want to be absolutely sure.
Yes, sir. No, go ahead. Come on.
No, my only comment is this: it's like, you know, health reform. We're like trying to beat the ball down the road, and each of us got sticks, and there's more than one ball on the road, and we're trying to just push them down. And this is just one little piece of.
But I don't want your ball to go flat if it somehow gets rolled over by 2009 because something's wrong with it.
Well, you know what? 2009 is going to roll over it anyway, if it's wrong. So, I agree. It is in... No, it's in 2000. I'm not going to disagree it's in 2009. But this effort, we continually have this conversation about primary care, and at some point, someone's going to listen and make some changes.
Yeah, and we started with 3097, and we keep moving. I intend to move this thing. I just think it makes sense since we have to wait for the fiscal anyway.
That's
Let's
fine.
Give everybody a chance to look at the dash shoes.
It's not fine.
We have another day or two. Thank you. Thanks, Representative.
We will carry over House Bill 3418 until Friday. Good thing we didn't have much of an agenda on Friday, only 30 bills, not counting when we carry over or something. We can carry it over to Monday, too.
I do want to remind the chair, there was something about the Wednesday and Friday after the committee's done with House bills that we might have some time off. I'm just reminding
you. We might have some time off. I have definitely said a week from Friday we will not meet, and maybe not Wednesday either.
Okay. Thank you for preserving our relationships with our family.
Absolutely. Could we... could we, I've closed the work session on House Bill 3418 and open a work session on, what's the one? Well, let's get an update on it. Do we have amendments? Where are we in it?
There's a dash 3 amendment that I've asked for the fiscal amendment.
Right, the dash
3
is
2, 3, 4.
It's on the back.
Yeah.
But we can't move it, I don't know.
Right, we can't move it.
The revenue is the other one.
Revenue?
No, it relates to the one above. It doesn't relate to that one.
Okay.
I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2345 and see if we can get an update on where we are. We have some amendments on it, I think, and Representative Maurer and the Governor staff. Tom, you want to join us on this one? No. Okay. Chickening out, huh? 2345. I'm doing out on a lot of these bills. We need to make sure we know what we're up to. They're going to die accidentally rather than on purpose.
And before we gavel out, let's go through everything again. Chair Greenlink, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify today. For the record, my name is Amber Hollister. I'm Governor Kulongoski's Deputy General Counsel. I've been asked today to testify for two purposes. First, to describe the Impaired Health Professional Program created by House Bill 2345-3, and second, to note where concerns raised by the Oregon Medical Association have been addressed by this version of the bill. I'll strive to keep my comments brief, and I'm happy to answer any questions the committee may have. Claudia Black, the Governor's Senior Policy Advisor on Health Care, is also here to answer any policy-related questions.
Before we get started,
yes,
there is not unanimous consensus on this bill from particularly the Oregon Medical Association, the Dental Association, the Pharmacy Board. So there are concerns, but some of those concerns were raised well before this process started, and we've attempted to come up with something that most people can at least accept and not fall on the sword for. And I'm not quite sure we're there yet. There's still maybe a little tripping to fall on the sword, but this is the best we can do. The dash three are the best we can do right now, and we are hoping, Tom Powers is laughing, and we are hoping that we can get this through and allow the conversation to continue. Okay. But I think there's some unanimity between myself and the chair that something has to change in this system. And so we are hopeful to at least move what we've got.
I don't think I have those amendments. So do
dash three?
Yeah, I don't have them.
Yeah. Do other people have the dash threes?
Sorry, I have the dash threes. Go ahead.
I'm going to get copies.
We have one in the packet. Have you got copies?
No, I have one.
Do we have copies of the dash threes? Why don't you work us through them right now anyway?
Thanks.
Okay, I'd be happy to do that, Chair Greenlink. I provided the committee with a flow chart that outlines the program created by House Bill 2345-3.
Do we have that?
Yes. I believe so. This here.
Nice flow chart.
Thank you, Representative Kotek.
Go ahead, thank you.
One of the directives the work group received was to separate any impaired health professional program from the boards. This bill accomplishes that task. House Bill 2345 involves three distinct entities: the Health Licensing Board, a monitoring entity that's housed at DASH, and an Impaired Health Professionals Programs, or IHPP, which is housed at DHS or administered by a contractor.
The board, which is the box at the top of this flowchart, functions to refer licensees to the program and receives reports on any substantial noncompliance from the IHPP through the monitoring entity. Its duties are outlined in Section 1A of the bill that you will soon be receiving. The system is set up so that the board can add requirements to its licensees in the IHPP to account for different practice settings. Self-referred licensees from participating boards may also independently enter the program, and the requirements for their participation are outlined in Section 1B sub 5. So if you notice on the flowchart, you can see the board-referred licensees and a summary of their requirements on the left side. The right side is the self-referred licensees and their separate list of requirements. The IHPP, which is the big box at the bottom of the chart, has the primary duty of administering diversion agreements and assessing licensees' compliance with the program. I won't go into detail, but there's more detail provided on the flowchart. The monitoring entity, which is the entity in the middle of this flowchart and is described in Section 1C of the bill, serves as an information conduit between the board and the IHPP. You may ask why the monitoring entity is necessary. You may recall Assistant Attorney General Foote and Warren Foote and Linda Grimm's helpful testimony probably about a month ago now regarding federal confidentiality requirements. Without delving into the weeds, the purpose of the monitoring entity is to ensure that if a licensee withdraws his or her consent for the exchange of information between the IHPP and the board will learn that the licensee is no longer in the program and have an opportunity to investigate further. Additionally, the monitoring entity ensures that while self-referred licensees are successfully participating in the program, their names remain confidential. Just a few highlights of this system. First of all, 2345-3 presents a streamlined system. There's one program, one IHPP program instead of many. This creates some significant cost efficiencies. The preliminary estimate from DHS on cost is that this program will cost boards $881 per licensee per year in the program. Right now, the Oregon Medical Board alone...
800 per person who's in the program.
Correct, Chair Greenlick. Additionally, the sidebars that the bill lays out for the diversion agreements are comprehensive and will increase accountability across the board for licensees in these programs. And also, this bill creates an audit system which will identify any problems in implementation. So just... In the spirit of keeping things brief, I'm happy to answer any questions about the layout here.
There's a question that always arises, and in fact it probably started this discussion, and that's the question of if the program, and I guess this in case is the IHPP, finds that a participant has been engaging in criminal acts, do they have the ability to report that to the boards?
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, I'd be happy to answer that question in two parts. We do have federal confidentiality requirements that we're bound by in the state of Oregon. We attempt to deal with those requirements by having all licensees that participate in this program sign a consent to have information exchanged between the Health Licensing Board and the IHPP. Assuming that that consent is in place, this bill requires that if the IHPP learns of any criminal acts by a licensee in the program, they are required to report that information to the monitoring entity within 24 hours. If, perchance, the licensee withdraws their consent for exchange of information prior to that report taking place, the monitoring entity would still enable the board to learn at least that the consent has been withdrawn so that they can investigate further.
But when they investigate further, they don't have access to the information that the program has found. Is that right?
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, that's correct. To the extent that there is information in the files of the IHPP, that information must
remain confidential when there's not a consent in place. I think the benefit of this program is that because there's mandatory reporting for substantial noncompliance, you won't have a file of noncompliance building up within the IHPP. The program is set up so that that information is moved to the board on a regular basis if it indeed is substantial noncompliance.
We have an example of a person who shows up with a positive toxicology test for alcohol, and they decide to withdraw their consent. That information is the same that goes to the board as somebody who's been found as a part of this program to be stealing prescription drugs from their patients.
So,
and it's exactly the same information that goes to the board. There isn't any way for the board to know what it was that triggered that person's withdrawal of consent.
Chair Greenleaf, if I understand your question, it's the assumption is that this consent has been withdrawn, and then the conduct occurs. And you're, in that case, you're correct. The only thing the board would receive from the monitoring entity is the name of the licensee that is no longer participating in the program.
Okay. That your reading of it?
Yes. Mr. Chairman, this is very complex.
It sure is.
Controversial within the boards. There's federal law that is very restrictive in how we can pass information. And I think I am comfortable moving forward. If this were to pass and be signed by the governor, I would want to know in 2011 what's happening. You know, where are we in this? Because I don't want to completely screw it up. But I don't think this does that. In fact, I think it gets us to a point where the protection of the public interest is now paramount as much as we can within federal law. But is this a 100% solution? No, and quite frankly, the only way you get a 100% solution is say, we don't have it at all. We don't have an impaired provider program at all, and I don't think we want that either. I think there are many, many cases where providers can be rehabbed and they can recognize problems that they have. But at the end of the day, the board's job, they have their number one job, is to take care of the public. And if they can't do that, then they're failing in their mission.
Does the board in this have authority when a professional has withdrawn consent to automatically at that point withdraw their license? Is that cause for a temporary suspension of license?
Chair Greenlake, members of the committee, I think the answer is that the board would need to proceed with its normal process at that point. Boards do have varying authority to do emergency suspensions, but I'm not able to speak to each specific board's authority to do that.
But why couldn't we put into the statute that when a person went into this program, if they withdrew their consent, to provide an automatic 30-day suspension while the board tries to figure out what's happening? Is there any legal reason why that couldn't be in the statute?
Chair Greenlake, I think we'd want to be careful of due process rights of the licensees, and I'd be happy to look at that issue and speak with our colleagues at Legislative Council about it.
I thought we had considered that somewhere along the process.
The answer is yes. I am comfortable allowing the boards, if there is a trigger, to do an investigation and allowing that process to work as it does today.
And under the due process, the model is I've been found in the program. Let's say the simple question. I positive for cocaine, and the board knows I'm out of the program because I've withdrawn my consent. And now the board calls the person in and says, you've withdrawn your consent. Why was that? And the person says, I just got tired of going to programs, and I don't want to screw around anymore. Okay, now what does the board do with that?
Chair Greenlink, members of the committee, the board would certainly have authority at that point to you know, engage in any sort of fitness examinations that it has normally. I mean, up to and including, I mean, boards do order toxicology tests themselves.
Well, here's what I would ask you to do. I'd ask you, when you check that, find out if it is legally possible to put into the amendment, I mean, to put an amendment into the bill that says if a person withdraws their consent after having not voluntarily going to the program, but been required to go into the program, if they withdraw their consent.
No, that's different.
Well, that's what I'm asking.
Okay.
I'm not asking about the voluntary ones. I'm perfectly happy. I'm talking about when a board puts somebody in under this. Under this model, they come in on the left-hand side of your of your graph. They sign a consent that says their information can be shared to the board. Then, under that, down at the bottom, the board is informed that the person has withdrawn from the program, has withdrawn their consent. Now the question is, why can't that trigger an automatic suspension?
Different question. Sorry.
Yeah. Chair Greenlink, members of the committee, I'm Holly Mercer from the Board of Nursing. I believe that in the original bill that was proposed, and there were due process issues. Currently, the boards only do, when you think about an automatic suspension and you talk about an emergency suspension, that is an extreme situation that we have absolutely dire facts that there is a public safety issue. People could withdraw their consent, and it could have nothing to do with dire safety facts at all. And I think that the hesitation from our council in terms of having an automatic 30-day suspension was that doesn't necessarily mean that there is a public safety issue. What it will trigger is an immediate investigation by the board. And if we find, based on that investigation, that there are serious safety issues, we could go in and we've got to pull the whole board in and do an emergency suspension.
But how could you find that, is my question.
Oh,
if this is information
yes.
that's buried in a treatment program.
We actually, we would start with a LEDS search. We would find out whether or not there's any criminal arrests that have been made. We would we would talk with witnesses. We would get personnel records. We have to start over. There is no question. We've got to, but we can do that quickly, and we can find out very quickly whether or not there is a safety issue involved.
Mr. Chair, may I? Before they're entering into the path in which the chair is suggesting is through a diversion agreement.
Right.
Correct.
So the stipulation is going to be within that diversion agreement. There's going to be a consequence
exactly.
to taking away your consent, because by not allowing consent, you're now violating the diversion agreement.
Yes.
That's the difference between the self-referral and...
Yes, and I think that it is one of degree in terms of taking away that license. Because when we automatically or emergency suspend someone, we say you cannot practice from that moment forward. Any time that we do that, we have to have pretty solid facts that we can take that license and pull them out of practice. Now, when they sign the diversion agreement, they don't withdraw their consent. They have agreed that if they have any substantial noncompliance, we put a restriction on their license. And
but
they've done
that's
that.
That's what I'm asking.
I'm asking
as a part of a diversion agreement.
Yes.
They've signed a diversion agreement.
Yes.
I mean, they've signed their consent. They withdraw consent. That means that you put a hold on their license at that point. As a result, every diversion agreement has to have that in it?
We will not do an emergency suspension at that point. We would start investigating.
Well, what I'm asking is that
if we
stipulate as a part of this law that any diversion agreement has in it, if the professional withdraws their consent for the information to go forward, that automatically trigger a 30-day suspension while you're trying to find out what was it about.
Unless it's an emergency suspension, they would have due process rights. They would be able to file a contested case on that. So what you're asking for is an emergency suspension. They would be automatically restricted from working at that point. I understand what you're saying.
Mr. Chair, can I ask a question? Are you wanting to grant the board the authority to be able to do it, or a requirement that the board has to do it?
I think as a part of this, any diversion agreement ought to have that. I mean, we talked about that, and there needed to be some teeth in the question of the withdrawal of the permission. And I think in a diversion agreement, I think it ought to be statutorily that it, that's required. Because you don't know what's going on, and it seems to me you need that 30 days to find out what's going on. And they also need to know that it better be significant if they withdraw their... This is something we ought to take offline, but what I would really like is, if this is legal, I'd like you to prepare an amendment to this that includes that. Yes, ma'am.
You won't get back to fiscal in time to move it to this. It'll die before we get a fiscal back.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
My suggestion is that this is the, for you and I, this is the 95% solution. And that
not the 5%
solution. Not the 40% solution. And I also would suggest that that is actually one of the points of contention by mandating some of this, and that we may lose some of the fragile support that we have on this bill.
Well, you still have some non-support, I think.
Well,
Okay. Let's consider the amendment. Let's be prepared to move the amendment when LC is done with their the kind of craziness they're going now. I'll get an amendment like that drafted and argue for it in the Senate. We can talk about even on
okay.
the... Yeah, I think I think you're right. I think we need to move it. It's pretty good. And if everybody in the committee's happy to move it in this form, we'll move it, and we'll... I'll make that statement on the House floor that I think it could be improved this way, and we'll try and get an amendment in the Senate to see if we can work it out without destroying things.
Quite frankly, if we're going to see this through, we're going to need to rally for this bill on the Senate side.
Yeah.
I think you and I will.
Okay. Thank you for all your work. I know you and Tom and Senator Mao have been working very hard on this with some folks.
Yeah.
We think this is a very important issue. We're very worried about it. We think it may be 3 times per 1,000 or some, I mean, not that much, but we think when it happens, you need to have the ability to deal with it in a way that makes some sense. And I really appreciate all your work.
Thank Amber and Claudia for all their efforts.
Thank
They're
you very
persistent,
much.
Huh?
Yeah.
Thank you, Chair and Representative Mauer.
Thank you. Let me... is this 2345?
Yes.
Let me close the work session on House Bill 2345 and move House Bill 2345 to Friday.
Can you say specifically to carry it over to Friday?
I'm sorry, to carry it over until Friday. Let me get the words right so we don't accidentally lose a bill because I said the wrong thing. I have good help here. Okay, can I open a work session?
We have 3 bills that we can move.
Which are the 3?
2589, which is the hearing aid bill.
That's the one I was looking for right now. Okay. Let's open a work session on...
2589.
I'm losing my marked up page here. 2589, why can't I find it?
$25.89.
Open up a work session on House Bill 2589. Madam Administrator, will you tell us where we are with this?
Yes, Mr. Chair. This is a bill that Representative Cannon is sponsoring. We had a work session on this. There are no amendments to this bill. This is the one that would provide hearing aids up to $48,000 or $4,000 a year.
for children who currently do not have that coverage typically under their health insurance programs. There is no revenue impact. You do have a copy of the fiscal impact. The fiscal impact of the bill is indeterminate, and you have that in your packet. I'm sure that Representative Cannon would like to speak.
Will you talk to us about this, please?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I think the fiscal statement is informative. They did work with DCBS, OMIP, and PEB and OEB to get a sense of what this requirement would mean for our state insurance programs and determined that any impact would be minimal or indeterminate. They really were not able to come up with any sense that this would add to costs in any kind of significant way. That is consistent with the information that we got from the carriers when we made our inquiries, and in my presentation when we heard this bill, I provided a summary of the data that we that my office received when we did a query of we worked with DCBS to query the carriers on what they anticipated this requirement would mean in terms of premium increases. The median estimate was an increase of 0.07% on premiums due to this coverage. So I think this is a small benefit that would make a significant difference for a small number of children of the state.
That's 0.07%.
0.07% was the median of the 9 carriers who we surveyed on their estimate for premium impacts related to this coverage. The range, it should be noted, was from 0.03% to 0.9%. So significant range, but the all but 3 of them were at 0.1% or below.
Okay. Is there, can we have a motion on this?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2589 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Is there any discussion on this? Representative Thompson.
Just a point of clarification. This program does, in your understanding, apply to state insurance programs as well as private?
That's a good question, and I'll go back to the fiscal statement. Yes, it would apply to state plans. PEB currently offers this benefit already.
Yeah.
OMIP does not. OEB insurers do not. Both OMIP and OEB estimate the impact would be minimal or indeterminate.
Okay. Any other discussion?
Yes, sir.
Hearing aids.
I have a problem with mandate, and I've had a thought to say this is fine, but what if we had a zero-sum game, a revenue or an income-neutral, revenue-neutral mandate policy where the insurance company said, okay, we'll do it, but this is what we're going to give up on the other end, that there's something that they're not going to cover as a result of this.
Something worth 0.07%.
We
have a statute that talks about what needs to happen before mandates are included.
And we haven't done that.
And I continue to be troubled by it. I really want to bring that statute out in the interim. And I didn't want to bring up, for example, I would have loved to apply that when we're discussing the autism mandate, which really troubles me a lot. Mm-hmm. And I would have loved to have used that statute. I think it was fair to pick it up and pull it out of the dustbin where it's been there. But I really want to do that. And I think one of the things we may want to do in the next session is, if not what you said, at least get everything together. So we're considering them as a mandate. We're considering mandates everyone we get, not one at a time, because it's true, if it's only 0.07% and we do 20 of them, now we're at Over 1%. And I think we need to make some sense out of this, in the same way we tried to make sense out of the whole question of the scope of practice. So, again, we're gathering a list, and for the interim. And as I said before, I want to start our interim work once we close down is our ability to do some work. And I consider this has got to be very high on the agenda, because we only go up.
Well, I would agree. We only go up, and there's no way you don't take something away. I mean, say the deck is full, folks. Figure out what you're going to take off somewhere in the top or the middle that's going to make this thing still 52 cars, because we can't afford what we have today.
And even with the two jokers. We have a little room.
Okay.
But it isn't unlimited, and that's the problem. Because I think it is true that every increase we add to it, we end up losing some insurance. And I know in a welter of a 17% rate increase, finding out the impact of what adding 0.07 was, or even 0.1...
It's impossible.
It is impossible. Yes, sir. Representative Broom.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And to Representative Maurer's point, it becomes even more important, that consideration, as we get to 2011 and what the recommendations of the health authority will likely be when it comes to mandates and how that plays out.
Yeah, and the requirement we put in to try and create a skinnier program to help small business buy it, which is in it. Yes.
Mr. Chair, I really agree wholeheartedly with you and Representative Maurer and Bruin, and would be happy to be part of an effort during the interim to examine these. The fact is they do come before us in isolation. They tend, at least to my eyes, all to look good. We know that the cumulative impact is real, and we need a process whereby to examine and prioritize the proposed mandates and the existing mandates. So I agree wholeheartedly. I mean, my case on this would be that, look, that the proponents of this bill, including me, will say this is such an important tool, especially for young children, and the costs associated with not having the benefit of a hearing aid are significant. Some of those costs are borne by the state. So I would hope that deliberative work during the interim would, you know, come up with establish a process where we would be weighing costs and benefits, seeing these not merely as cumulative rate premium impacts, but also potential cost savings at some point downstream.
In other places in
sure.
societies.
Yep.
Okay. Is there any other discussion on this? Would you call the roll, please? We have a motion before us to add hearing aids for kids under 18 to a health insurance mandate. And let's have a roll call.
Vice Chair Maurer?
No.
Representative Thompson?
Yes.
Representative Bruin?
Yes.
Representative Cannon?
Aye.
Representative Dembro?
Aye.
Representative Garrett?
Aye.
Vice Chair Harker?
Aye.
Representative Kennemer?
Aye.
Representative Kotek?
Aye.
Chair Greenlick?
Aye. Motion passes. Representative Cannon, will you carry this on the floor, please?
Yes.
We can. What do we have left? We have 2604.
We have two more bills that we could pass out today or not, and we also could do the public hearing on 2129, which is Representative Kotek's bill.
Okay. We can work with. We can work with. 2604, is that right?
Mm-hmm.
What else have we got?
2604 is not ready. Okay. The two that are ready to move out are 2656, and then 2925 has been on our agenda for about three sessions. It's the one with the 90-day prescription drug.
There are both two more mandates, huh? I have sort of reviewed the committee. And I don't find a ton of enthusiasm for 2925. I don't find a ton of opposition either. It was sort of seven shrugs and two no's. I think we're going to let that one go.
29.25.
I will not carry over and we'll let that go.
Okay. We have 26.56.
26.56. I will carry over. We'll. I will take a take some temperature on that. Which one are we talking about? 26.56. I'll carry that over, 26.56, until
Friday.
Well, until Friday is all we're doing. We only carry over one day at a time.
Right.
Okay. Did I say the magic words?
Yes.
29.20. I'm sorry, what's the number again? 21.29. I'm going to open a public hearing on 21.29. Representative Kotek, will you start us on that?
I would be happy to.
Is there a sign-up sheet out there somewhere?
Public hearing.
Public hearing.
Comparative effectiveness.
I think there's a proposed gut stuff.
Good afternoon, colleagues. For the record, Tina Kotek, State Representative, House District 44, North and Northeast Portland. Before us today is House Bill 2129. For the purpose of replacing the bill with a -1 amendment, the original bill speaks to, as a relating to health services, relating clause, something about the Health Resources Commission, but the -1 amendment is our return to that surgical checklist discussion. We had had an amendment drafted to include requiring the development of a surgical checklist, and then requiring hospitals to utilize it, and it seemed that that was a little too much in the weeds for House Bill 2009, but you hate to have a good idea go away too quickly. So we have a little bill here that seemed it needed some happier content, and so what we have here is a -1 that would ask the Oregon Patient Safety Commission to develop a uniform surgical checklist, and as we recall, there had been some national press coverage about the safety and cost savings around hospitals using these checklists in the operating rooms to make sure they had the right patient or they knew who they were working with, and you know all the good things that we should do when you're assuming it's done in the OR. So this bill, like I said, asked the Patient Safety Commission to develop the checklist. Ask them to report back to the legislature. It would become operative. Section 1, we have different operative dates here, but basically the goal is develop a list and have it used by Oregon's hospitals.
Okay.
And that's what I got.
Have you talked to the Patient Safety Commission? Do they have a position on this?
Mm-hmm. I'll have my trusty legislative assistant join us at the table here. Ryan, would you like to chat?
Is this your first time testifying to this committee?
Yes, Chair.
Welcome.
Chair.
You've been lurking
for quite a while. Thank you, Chair. Yes, I did speak with the...
For the record,
my name is Ryan Essman, and I'm the health policy consultant to Representative Kotek from North Portland. I did speak with the chair of the Patient Safety Commission, Jim Dameron, and he said that traditionally Patient Safety Commission does not mandate that things go forward. They develop procedures, and that this particular development in quality improvement was there was some difficulties with implementing it, and that their traditional role was not in mandating such things. We don't actually have the mandate in the bill by the Patient Safety Commission. The state would actually mandate that. But they were very supportive of making sure that a checklist was developed and implemented. And their last meeting actually was on this subject.
I know they're working on this issue anyhow. Mr. Holt, can you join us?
I'm very interested. This is getting way into the weeds. I mean, if
my constituents will say, why are you wasting time with this?
But weeds aren't a terrible thing, Representative.
There's a lot of weed issues in this building.
Mr. Holt, do you have a position on this one?
Yes, Chair Greenlick, members of the committee. For the record, Tom Holt with the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. had the opportunity to meet with Representative Kotek just yesterday about this, and we had a nice conversation, but we agreed to disagree, I think. And our objection to the bill is not at all about having checklists. In fact, we're in the process of test sledding one right now. Beginning April 1 through the Institute of Health Improvement, which is a national group, we have circulated to a physician at a number of facilities to try it out. We expect it to be finalized within the next few weeks, and my understanding is we have some agreements with OMA to help circulate that once it's finalized amongst the right people at our facilities and amongst surgeons. So it's something that we're working on very actively. The difficulty we have with a bill is that it's taking the Patient Safety Commission in a direction that it hasn't traditionally done. And I was part of the work group in a different capacity that developed the Patient Safety Commission. And one of the constants we had in the year or so it took to develop that was that the commission would not take on anything that looked or like a regulatory role. And while this is not regulatory per se, it is embarking in new territory of the Patient Safety Commission, kind of saying, here is the thing that you ought, that we want you to do very specifically. The commission is set up more as sort of a, it does a couple of big things. And one is sort of an information exchange place, and they are involved in the conversations on lots of things as they are involved in this particular issue. It's also a safe harbor where providers can report problems, errors, and for analysis on the theory that we want, say, Providence and Legacy to know about each other's errors through the Patient Safety Commission in a blinded way, so that if there's a pattern emerges, then that can be identified as something that people would like to work on. To give you an example of something, and I guess the underlying question here, whether or not we ought to have a bill, is, you know,
How about if we assign you guys to do it?
We're actively doing it right now, and we expect that work to be completed soon. We'd be happy to come back to you with a report about what we've done. My understanding is we recently completed some work on wristbands, and the Patient Safety Commission was helpful in that. And what we came up with was a system that all hospitals adopted using the same color wristband. When you check in, you get banded, and those bands have different colors. And there's a color for your patient that has allergies, so that's something to check before medication is administered. There's a different color band for do not resuscitate orders and so on. There's not a long list, but there's a short list of bands, and we actually, the association engaged in procuring the bands and distributing them, and that way physicians and nurses who work at different facilities don't get mixed up and do the wrong thing. So everybody has the same system. So, I think we can be trusted to move forward on this. We are moving forward very actively. We just have concern. We have significant concerns about setting a precedent in statute of the Patient Safety Commission doing something very specific that is kind of wandering into the weeds. And I guess, one person's weed is another's natural plant. But
I was asking a very specific question. How would your association react if we substituted the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems? Everywhere it says Patient Safety Commission in this bill. I don't know how the sponsor how would you react?
Chair Greenlich, that's a very intriguing idea. I would certainly be willing to check it with the powers that be at the association to the extent that we're doing it anyway. My top of mind thought is why not, but again...
Or failing it, giving us a strong letter,
it's
committing to doing this in the interim, and we won't need a bill.
Yeah, we certainly would welcome a letter from the committee to come back and report to you about our work.
No, a letter from you to us saying you're going to do that is what I would suggest.
It's a matter of public record, I think, at this point, and would be happy to give you a letter that says we are moving forward on a checklist and we're doing it.
Well, let's close this hearing right now.
May I respond?
Oh, you actually may.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Let's carry it over and get the fiscal that goes with this and other things.
I think that'd be great. I just want to clarify, you know, the bill's pretty simple. It's the Safety Commission is not taking, as I think was pointed out, a regulatory role. When we had the original amendment for 2009, it had been stated the Health Resources Commission would develop the checklist, and people are like, oh, no, the Patient Safety Commission is who does that work. They are. They're the ones who have all the patient safety gurus sitting around a room figuring this out. They're the right person to say, to kind of, you know, green light a list. It could be the very list the association comes up with. I don't think there's anything wrong with that since they're an active member of the commission. But the bill says that you will use it by a certain date and that the commission will report back by a certain day on how well it's working. My only concern with having some discussion about developing the checklist, how do we know anyone's using this? If I went out and talked to the average person, I know this sounds like a weed issue, this passes like the duh test, like there's no tomorrow. If I'm getting surgery tomorrow, I would like to know from a consumer perspective that each hospital in the state of Oregon actually has some mechanism to make sure it's the right people in the room doing the right procedure.
If I were getting surgery tomorrow, I want to know that hospital is doing it.
Well,
for tomorrow, I wouldn't care about anybody else.
There you go. I would be in favor of something different as long as somewhere down the line we're actually saying maybe they report back to the Patient Safety Commission, say we are using it, because right now we can develop one, but it's completely voluntary and.
Let's ask the Patient Safety Commission to come back. Let's carry it over till, say, Friday, because that's all we can do. They resisted, you remember, the hospital taking on the hospital infection thing because the reports were public. In this case, would you be comfortable with them doing it in their confidential?
But let me, model? This isn't about errors. The confidentiality issue is around errors. This is around saying we are trying to prevent errors, and here's a procedure to do that. So I don't think the confidentiality issue is germane.
Chair Greenlink, if I may, within a relatively short time, I can say with high confidence that based on the information I've been given, every hospital in the state will be using a checklist. There's no resistance to the idea of doing one. The issue here is, you know, making sure that it's an appropriate list and that we don't create something in statute that, you know, next year somebody has a different idea that they would like to put in. These things have a habit of sticking around once they are in statute.
Let me propose this for Monday. Let's ask Mr. Dameron to join us to comment on it from the Patient Safety Commission. If not him, somebody else from there. Let's ask you to go back to your folks and see if they want to make some stronger, more definitive statement that comes to us specifically about this, other than we're opposed to putting it in statute.
Mr. Chair, if you would like a letter from us saying that it is our intention that every one of our members utilizes a surgical checklist, I'm pretty sure I can get that letter
for
you.
And that we will put the power of the association behind that. Let's put it all in a mix and see where we're going, all right?
Thank you.
Monday at 3. Yes. Yes, Representative Harker. Anybody else?
Good question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Did I understand correctly that the pilot you're doing is with the World Health Organization's surgical checklist available on the site from IHI?
Chair Greenlink, Representative Harker, I'm not familiar with all the technical detail of what's going on, but it's my understanding that's the basis of the work.
Okay, and Representative Kotek, have you seen this and checked it out? It seems, I mean, it's there. It looks pretty thorough. It's also given as a template for U.S. use. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay. We will carry over House Bill. Oh, wait a minute. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2129. Open a work session on House Bill 2129. Close the work session on House Bill 2129 and carry it over to Friday. To Friday. What else could we do today?
We could get in. There's no other bills that we can actually work
other
on
bills
today.
We can work.
But we could, you know, if you wanted to do it. There are amendments to
Is there another public hearing that we had scheduled for today?
your, just your 2117, which you've carried over to Friday.
Oh, did I need to open the public hearing to do that?
No. That was a public hearing.
And a workshop. I'll carry it over.
It is carried over. So.
This won't surprise you, but all that 2117 is doing is carrying a relating clause relating to health that might let us, in case we get into some issues that we want. And my intention would be to move it to rules when we're done. The substance of 2117 is in 2116. No, this was the Kids Connect piece. So we did carry that over, and it's not, don't anybody come in for the public hearing, please. Let me carry over House Bill 2118 to Monday. I hope we're going to be able to work that. I think we have some amendments on it. We'll ask for a fiscal on those amendments. That should be fairly straightforward. On House Bill 2056, I'm going to propose, I do have an amendment, the dash two amendments, that I want to work on that. And we heard from all the boards, including the dental board and other boards, that they'd be fine if we wanted to add a public member just so we didn't do anything else. The dash two amendments on House Bill 2056, add a public member to each of the boards that were in 2056. A couple of them have enough public members now. And I'll announce that, and if anybody wants to signal to us that that causes a problem, let us know by Monday, but I hope to have a fiscal on that, by Friday. But I hope to work that if we get the fiscal on 2056.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, ma'am.
I do have a dash one for 2056. Are you aware of that?
I am.
Okay. Thank you.
Carry over House Bill 2056. I have already carried over, I think, House Bill 2552, but I'll do it again just to make sure. We have passed 2589. We're not yet ready to work 2604, is that right? We don't have the fiscal for that. I hope we will. I'll carry over 2604 to Friday. Are you going to produce a new agenda for Friday?
It's being produced.
I mean, yes. With the carryover, the carryovers will be on it?
Yes.
It's going to be crazy.
Yes.
We may not get it all done on Friday. it's possible.
Kelso.
We're not ready to work 3228 yet, are we?
No.
I'll carry over 3228
to Friday.
I'll carry over 3236 to Friday. I've gotten some strong negative comments on that, Representative Thompson. Have you seen that?
I would support that, Mr. Chair. We got some testimony today with some pretty strong factual distortions in it that I think needs to have a response. And
you'll be ready by
I think
Friday.
The Board of Pharmacy should respond to it because it's some of the issues are pretty important.
Did you carry over
3230? Where did you hear that testimony?
Yeah. We have some written testimony from, I think, the OMA.
And you're saying that that's factually distorted?
Let's just say there appear to be misunderstandings in that from what actually goes on.
Okay.
And I think the Board of Pharmacy will want to address that probably.
Okay.
Carry over 3262 to Friday.
And did you carry over 3236, or did we just talk about it?
I did carry over. I'll make sure I say it again. Carry over 3236.
Good.
I think I did say that. And
now we know.
And
carry over 2118 on the other page in case I haven't yet.
What about 20 pages?
Anything else I want to make sure I carried over? You know, I'm not going to carry over 2009. I haven't said that for a long time.
Before you close the public
hearing,
let me just check the law.
I'm going through everyone right now.
3230.
Third from the bottom.
Hearing over 2702.
No, we passed.
No, past 2702.
That's it.
Yep.
We will have 30,000.
It's all right. We're good.
Did I carry over 3418? I want to make sure I did. 3418.
Yeah,
that's probably. Carry over 2117. Friday. And I'll say it a number of times. Carry over 2129.
You can. Again.
You guys can take off. I'm just waiting to find out. Make sure I carry over everything.
Okay. How many times do we have to carry it over? Before it's officially carried over?
At least once.
Private dining.
Okay, all right. Us is an event.
Event. Those OBA tickets. OBA tickets. No,
I hope I get an invite.
Yeah.
Okay.
Did you?
I'm paying. No.
Foxy, right. You got it?
I got an invitation.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I got an invitation.
We're adjourned.
Woohoo!
Yeah.